Hi, everybody. My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic.
Welcome to tape number one, or recording number one, session number one of the Big Book Study in Action group. Mary and I have been doing this for a number of years. Our job here is to be guides. We've done this a number of times with individually one-on-one with other alcoholics, and we've done these in seminar kinds of settings, big group settings. So anyway, we're going to do that. We're going to be reading the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the fourth edition of the big book, and it tells us on the dust cover of the fourth edition of the big book that it's the basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I was a young man, I learned that you read a textbook differently than you read a novel. A novel, usually I'm laying down or on a couch or in a comfortable chair, and I read for a while, and I may finish a half a chapter and then kind of fall asleep or whatever. A textbook is different. I sit upright at a table or a desk. I usually have a pad of paper, highlighters, that sort of thing along with me, and I study the book, and that's what we're going to be doing here. The book was written by the first 100 men and women who had achieved sobriety by 1939 when the book was published. It was not written by one individual. There is no what publishers call a byline. A byline is where it says the book is by so-and-so. This does not have that. It's written by the first 100 men and women. And what they did was Bill would do some writing. He'd pass it on to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob would fix it, change it, add to it, subtract from it, give it to the Akron groups. They'd do the same thing with both Bill and Bob's writings. They would ship it back to Bill in New York, and Bill would give it to the New York, guys in the New York group. And they'd go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until they absolutely, that's their words, absolutely agreed on everything that's in the book.
So we're introducing two names that you might not be familiar with. The first is Bill Smith. Oh, sorry, it's
Bill Wilson.
Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, and they are our co-founders, the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous.
And Bill lived in New York City, and Dr. Bob lived in Akron, Ohio, which was the two centers for our fellowship. So we're going to read this with a dictionary, and Mary is particularly going to talk about what the words meant. We use a dictionary printed in the 1930s because that's the language that they were using. There are two words to give you an example of how words have changed since the book was written in 1939. The first is the word prejudice. That word is used many, many times in the text section of the book. Prejudice in the 1930s did not mean the way we interpret it today. Today we interpret that word in racial terms because we are products of America after the Civil Rights Movement. This book was written before the Civil Rights Movement, and it meant old ideas, ideas formed without full knowledge. It did not have a racial overtone. And another word that's used is on page 163 as they're wrapping up the text section of the book, and moving on to the story section in the back of the book, they say, "We'll surely meet some of you as we trudge the road of happy destiny." That doesn't make any sense. If we're trudging, how can it be happy? If we're happy, why are we trudging? Until we go back to a dictionary printed around the time the book was written, and we find that the word trudge meant to walk or march slowly and carefully or with purpose. Aha! Now the first 100 have been able to communicate to me. So as I walk slowly on this road of recovery, I'm going to surely meet some of you. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not going to spend a great deal of time on that. We might have a tape later in this sequence or on this website with more of that information. But just know that when we refer to the history, who these people were, who the first 100 were, and so on, we're going to be using the three principal history books that are published by Alcoholics Anonymous. The first is Pass It On, and that's the story of the New York groups. The second is Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. That's the story of the founding of AA in Akron, Ohio. And the last is Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. That's what has happened to AA since the 1950s. We are also going to use a book that is not published by Alcoholics Anonymous, but we think it's a very good book. It's a book entitled Not God. It's written by Ernest Kurtz. It is actually his PhD thesis. He wrote this thesis for his PhD at Rutgers University. And his PhD was in alcoholism studies. The value principally of the book, it's a good history book, but one of the principal values is, like any PhD thesis, the bibliography takes up probably half of the book. And it gives you all kinds of resource information if you would like to further explore the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're going to look at how the book is laid out. We're going to turn to the table of contents.
On page V or 5 in Roman numerals.
So the book is laid out, the preface, the foreword of the first, second, third, fourth edition, and some of the doctor's opinion is a brief history of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're only going to read the preface and some of the foreword to the first edition here. We're going to, at the very end of this session, cover the foreword to the second, third, and fourth edition because there's some nice historical information in there. Much of the doctor's opinion, chapter 1, Bill's story, chapter 2, there is a solution, and part of more about alcoholism is about step 1. It's interesting that we're not even going to get to the instructions for step 1 until we have read nearly 50 pages, 30 pages in the text material, plus the doctor's opinion, plus the appendices. I think they wanted us to pay attention to step 1. I think they wanted us to make sure we were firmly grounded in the fact that we are alcoholics and what that means. The second half of More About Alcoholism and We Agnostics is about step 2. Chapter 5, How It Works, is about steps 3 and 4. Chapter 6, Into Action, They Weren't Kidding, that's about step 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And chapter 12...
No, chapter 7.
Excuse me, thank you. Chapter 7, Working with Others, is about step 12. You will notice as we go through here, occasionally we will correct each other. That's just hunky-dory. We've done that. We interrupt each other in this study. We're very used to that. We've been doing this for a long, long time, and it doesn't bother us a bit. So don't worry about the fact that Mary just corrected me. Mm-hmm. I don't take offense to it. And so then chapter 8, 9, and 10 is about step 10 in those specific environments with our spouses, with our families, and with our employers. There's a myth around AA that Bill Wilson wrote the chapter Two Wives. That's not true. How do we know it's not true? Because Bill said it wasn't true. He said that during a talk in the 50s in Dallas, Texas. He said, I did not write it. We don't know who did. He never told us who did, but he did tell us it wasn't him. Chapter 11, A Vision for You, is about building a fellowship around you. So we're going to go ahead and get started with the...
Before we do that, let's also look at the fact that there are some personal stories in the back of the book, and we'll be reading about how they're organized as we read the foreword. So let's move to page XI, Preface.
So before we get started just doing this work, Mary and I typically do a prayer, which is included in the website. You can find this in the website. It's called the Set-Aside Prayer. We think it properly...
That's the tone for the work we're going to do.
Thank you.
God, please let me set aside everything I think I know about sobriety, life, and you so that I may be open to a new experience. Amen.
We'll start reading the preface, which is on page XI or 11 for you non-Romans.
Preface. This is the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first edition appeared in April 1939, and in the following 16 years, more than 300,000 copies went into circulation. The second edition, published in 1955, reached a total of more than 1,150,500 copies.
We are now selling approximately 1 million copies of the book a year.
The third edition, which came off press in 1976, achieved a circulation of in my book it says 11,698,000 because I have one of the first printings of the fourth edition, but essentially it's 19,550,000.
We sold a number of third edition books after the fourth edition came out, so that's the reason for those differences.
Because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it.
Two things about that sentence. First of all, it telling us, in case we lost the dust cover or bought a soft cover version of the book which doesn't have a dust cover, they're telling us that it's a textbook. They're telling us how to read this. In addition to the fact, they're telling us that there may be changes in the text section of the book, but they're not radical. There's nothing that's been radically changed. The General Service Conference will, from time to time, move paragraphs around, change sentences around, but no real major changes in it, and I would agree that there haven't been any radical changes.
And especially when we talk about the instructions for how to do each of the steps, there have been no changes. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program.
So the recovery program is in the book. It is described in this textbook. So if somebody says in a meeting that the program says or the program suggests or whatever, if it's not in the book, then it's not part of the program. The recovery program is described in this textbook. And it has been, so I'll start that sentence again. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left in untouched in the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth edition. The section called the doctor's opinion has been kept intact just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor.
You notice the word society has been capitalized twice in this paragraph. When you capitalize a word in the middle of a sentence, it means it's a proper noun. This is a synonym for the word fellowship with a capital F. So in the early days, they did not have the name Alcoholics Anonymous. They actually referred to themselves as a society or a fellowship. The second edition added the appendices, the 12 traditions, and the directions for getting in touch with AA. But the chief change was in the section of personal stories, which was expanded to reflect the fellowship's growth. So again, you see that proper noun, the word fellowship, capitalized.
Yeah, so that's the worldwide organization of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Bill's story, Dr. Bob's nightmare, and one other personal history from the first edition were retained intact. Three were edited, and one of those was retitled. New versions of two stories were written with new titles. 30 completely new stories were added, and the story section was divided into three parts under the same headings that are used now. In the third edition, Part 1, Pioneers of AA, Part 1 was left unchanged. 9 of the stories in Part 2, They Stopped in Time, were carried over from the second edition. 8 new stories were added. In Part 3, They Lost Nearly All, 8 stories were retained, 5 new ones were added. The fourth edition includes the 12 concepts for world service and revises the three sections of personal stories as follows. One new story has been added to Part 1, and two that originally appeared in Part 3 have been repositioned there. 6 stories have been deleted. 6 of the stories in Part 2 have been carried over. 11 new ones have been added, and 11 taken out. Part 3 now includes 12 new stories. 8 were removed in addition to the 2 that were transferred to Part 1.
Alcoholics Anonymous has printed a book that contains all of the stories that have been deleted from these several 4 editions of the book. And that book is called Experience, Strength, and Hope. It should be available at your intergroup or central office. If it is not, you can always buy it online at AA.org.
So essentially, they just recapped how they have changed the composition of the stories in the back of the book, yet they kept those same 3 categories. The Pioneers, They Stopped in Time, and They Lost Nearly All.
And here's the reason, here's the purpose for changing those.
All changes made over the years in the Big Book, AA members' fond nickname for this volume, have had the same purpose, to represent the current membership of Alcoholics Anonymous more accurately and thereby to reach more alcoholics. If you have a drinking problem, We hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me. Or more important, yes, I felt like that. Or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too.
So we're going to go on to the forward to the first edition. We're going to only read we're going to read selected paragraphs from this. This is the forward as it appeared in the first printing of the first edition in 1939. We of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now this is the first of several chapters that they start with the word we. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind. To show other alcoholics...
Mind and body.
Oh, I forgot the body part. Yes. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. They italicize that. That means they want us to pay attention. So they're going to tell us, not in a general way, they're going to tell us very, very specifically what they did, not what they think.
Did you want to talk about the word recovered?
Yeah, thank you. They refer to themselves in this book as recovered, and they have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Does that mean they're cured? No. They felt they were recovered in this way. Let's say somehow I was shot with a gun, and I didn't die. They take me to a hospital. They can pull a bullet out of me, and they can patch me up, and I can do some convalescing in the hospital. I will be able to, if I don't die, recover from the gunshot wound. Does that mean I'm bulletproof? I can go down to the target range and stand in front of the guys shooting target practice? No. It means that I recovered from the wound. I am not immune. Mm-hmm. So they believe that they recovered. And I personally like that. It tells me that I can become, instead of it being in a constant state of convalescing, I'm a recovering alcoholic, I can recover from this disease. It means that I can be a service provider. I can carry the message to the next person. I'm not constantly recovering. Will more be revealed? Yes. Am I immune to this? No.
And the way we have recovered is by doing all 12 steps. For them,
thank you.
We hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary.
Authentication means proof.
We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all.
Interesting prophetic statement. There are now almost 200 12-step organizations in the world that use the same basic 12 steps for other kinds of maladies. Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, all kinds of things.
It is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication.
So they believed, based on a meeting that Bill Wilson, our New York co-founder, had with the editor of Reader's Digest, that they were going to, the Reader's Digest people were going to publish a condensed version of the book Alcoholics Anonymous in their magazine. And based on that assumption, that misinformation, as it was, as it turned out to be, they printed 4,975. They ordered 5,000, but a few got destroyed by the press. 5,000 books. There's only 100 recovering people in the entire universe. So they believed that that article in the Reader's Digest was going to create lots and lots of interest. Bill Wilson went back to the editor of Reader's Digest after this book came off the press, and the editor said, well, that isn't what I said, Bill. What I said was I would submit it to the editorial board, which he did, and the editorial board decided not to print a condensed version of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So now the first 100 are stuck with this book. It took them years and years to sell those 5,000 books.
Now, let's go back to the beginning of that paragraph, because the word anonymous means nameless, or bearing no author's name. So again, they're being anonymous as they publish this book. Being mostly business or professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. We would like it understood that our alcoholic work is an avocation. Avocation is in your glossary. It comes from the word in Latin meaning vocare, to be called. If you put an A in front of a word, it means not. So what they're saying is, This is not our vocation, which would be our paid work. It is an avocation. It is something that is other than your job.
We do it for free and for fun. And Mary talked about the glossary. That is on the website. You can print that if you want, or just use it for reference, however you choose to do it. And it is taken from that a dictionary printed in the 1930s, 1934 to be precise. That was the language that the authors were using. That's why we use this glossary.
When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to admit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Personal name is our last name.
Very earnestly, we ask the press also to observe this request, for otherwise we shall be greatly handicapped. We are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking.
So when the preamble that was written by our international magazine, the AA Grapevine, was copyrighted, they said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Why didn't they use the original wording? My guess is that they probably said, who's going to be the arbiter of whether you're honest about this desire to stop drinking or not? So they took it out when the Grapevine copyrighted our preamble.
We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone.
Isn't that great to know that we don't oppose anybody?
We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted.
Even better news, their only aim is to be helpful to us who are afflicted with the disease of alcoholism.
We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics. The word commenced is in your glossary. It means begin. So they're looking for people who have actually started doing the 12-step work and helping other alcoholics. They want to know how it's going.
So Mary used the term 12-step work. It's a word that's used in AA, and it's not very well understood. When the book refers to it, when we refer to 12-step work, we're talking about one alcoholic working with another alcoholic, working the steps together. It is not making coffee or setting up the meeting room for the meeting or answering the phones at our local central office. Those things are important, but it is not 12-step work. Those things make 12-step work possible. So answering phones at our central office, we're making 12-step work possible. We're taking calls from still suffering alcoholics, and we pass them on to people who can then do one-on-one work with that other alcoholic.
We should like to be helpful to such cases. So again, they want to be helpful to the people who have started working with others. Inquiry by scientific, medical, and religious societies will be welcomed.
It was this particular sentence caused lots of consternation on the part of the first 100, the authors of this book, because they said, wait a minute, if we ask those people, we may get a bad reaction from scientific, medical, or religious societies. They may not like the book. They may think it lacks orthodoxy or that it's not an appropriate. There were some of the first 100 that were afraid of that. However, what they discovered is that when they opened themselves up with the truth about alcoholism, they were welcomed with open arms in those communities, and we had nothing to fear for being open. We're going to read, I want to read one thing out of the foreword to the second edition. And it's important because we need to know, so how successful is this program of recovery? Why would I want to do these 12 steps? They're not fun. They're easy, but they're not fun. Why would I want to do that?
Let's turn to page XX.
That's Roman numeral 20.
20.
For you non-Romans.
Forward to the second edition.
The fifth line down, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, what do they mean by really tried? When they were surveying the membership for writing this forward, they said, have you worked all 12 steps? If the answer to that was yes, then you were included in the survey. If you said, no, I've only worked 11, I'm just getting ready to get started on 12, or I've only done 6, or I've only done 10, you were not counted. That's the way surveys are done. Every treatment center in the world does not count people who dropped out of their program in the middle of it. Same with us. We have a 12-step program. If you haven't worked all 12 steps, you were counted. So here's what their statistics are. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. So we're already at a 75% recovery rate in the first 16 years of AA's existence. It is the best possible intervention against alcoholism that has ever been discovered. And the 12 steps were not invented, they were discovered. We'll talk about that a little later. The best treatment center in the universe gets about 40%. Here we're at 75% over 16 years. And then they go on to say, and among the remainder, and those who stayed on with AA's, those who stayed on with AA showed some improvement. Or the thousands came to AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. So they're already telling us there's a difference between meetings and the program. Some came to meetings and decided they didn't want the program. And that's a thing that we don't stress a lot in meetings, at least in our part of the world, in places we've been. We tend to stress meetings, and meetings do not get you sober. The steps get you sober. But great numbers of these, about two or three, began to return as time passed. So the number 75% is going to increase somewhat. To what level? It's kind of hard to figure that out from that paragraph. But it tells us that the most successful intervention against alcoholism is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So,
now we're going to move to the doctor's opinion, which is in the part before page 1, so it's on page XXV, or 25.
When the first printing of the first edition, it was page 1. It was not chapter 1, it was page 1. And there is a move afoot in our Alcoholics Anonymous General Service Conference. If you don't know what that is, go to a meeting and ask somebody. And if your meeting people don't know what it is, you might be in the wrong meeting.
That's Dick's opinion, by the way.
Yeah, we try to differentiate between what's opinion, my opinion or Mary's opinion,
and
what's
facts.
In the book. Yeah, what's in the book. But there is a move afoot to put this back as page 1 and leave Bill's story as chapter 1. We'll see if that ever happens.
The doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book.
An estimate is an opinion, another synonym for that, and a plan of recovery is the same as a program of recovery.
Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter.
So this is the first 100 that have been talking to us. Now here's the letter. And this is a letter not from just some guy that just got out of medical school. This is a well-known doctor, a chief physician, the highest you can be, at a nationally prominent hospital. So this is no slouch. This is the guy that's at the top of his game.
You want to talk about who that is?
Well, we're going to find out when we read this first thing. But his name is Dr. William D. Silkworth. He was non-alcoholic. He had been an Army surgeon during World War I, came out of the Army, and went to work at Towns Hospital.
In New York City.
In New York City. Towns Hospital was originally started as to treat the wounded soldiers coming out of World War I. In World War I, every single solitary wounded soldier, everyone, 100%, were addicted to morphine. And here's why. If they're wounded on the battlefield, they would get morphine. Then they would be put on a truck and sent, which would take a couple of days, and they would end up in Paris where their wounds would be more permanently treated. Still on a morphine drip, they would be shipped to the coast of France where they would be put on a ship and shipped back to the United States, which was anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks in the ship. By the time they got back to the United States, they'd been on a morphine drip for more than 6 weeks. Every single solitary wounded soldier in World War I was addicted to morphine. It was a huge, huge public health issue in the day. Dr. Silkworth was treating those drug addicts, and he became interested in the alcoholics that came through that facility. And he's going to talk a little bit about that. So here's his letter.
So let's go a little further into that, though, that he is the chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction. Let's be clear about the fact that he is going to concern his remarks only to alcoholism. And this gets at our singleness of purpose.
they have a huge amount of respect for each other here. Their first 100 in writing, they say the hospital specializes in alcoholic and drug addiction. But the very first sentence, when Dr. Silkworth writes, he says, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. The respect that's going back and forth is quite interesting. The doctor, Dr. Silkworth, respects Alcoholics Anonymous and its singleness of purpose enough to not talk about drugs in his letters.
And singleness of purpose really means we do one thing and we do one thing very well, and that is work with alcoholics.
The solution to drug addiction, Emotions Anonymous, over-gambling, all of those things are the same thing, but the disease is different.
So let's go into the letter. This is his first letter. You're going to see there are two letters in this chapter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless.
So this patient is our co-founder in New York, Bill Wilson.
In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery.
So the ingredients for the 12 steps have been rattling around in the universe for almost since man crawled out of the cave. The ingredients of the 12 steps were known by the medical community. And Bill Wilson is going to get that information from Dr. Silkworth, and it's going to be explained quite well in this section of the book. Some of the information was known by the religious community, and that is the information that was passed on to Bill from his childhood friend, who Mary just read about. Ebbie Thatcher is the man's name. And then some of the ideas were known by the psychiatric community, and that information came to us from a man by the name of Roland Hazard, who had been a patient of Dr. Carl Jung, who was very often referred to as the father of modern psychiatry. And he brought that to New York. He came to New York, and he brought that. So Bill is about to get all, he's going to be the vessel that all three of the ingredients come together. They've never been placed together before.
As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others.
Well, wait. I hear in AA meetings all the time, there's no must in the big book. Why would people say that when there it is? I'm guessing it's because they have never read the book. It actually shows up about 111 times, and if you add in words like should, ought to, requirement, and those sorts of harder words, it increases the list by about 20%.
So the word conceptions is in your glossary, and essentially it's your ideas. Mm-hmm. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely.
That fits with what we know about history. Dr. Silkworth says he knows scores. A score is 20. The word is plural. He says he knows about 40 or more people of cases who were of the type other methods had failed completely. He was in New York. Of the first 100 that wrote the book, about 60 were in Akron, Ohio, and about 40 were in New York. And Dr. Silkworth did, in fact, know all of the members of AA at the time the book was printed. He used to come to AA meetings. He was kind of treated as an honorary member, though we don't have such a category.
These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. The word epoch is in your glossary. It just means may mark a new era or a new date. And the annals of alcoholism just means the history of alcoholism. So he sees this as a very important solution, and he thinks it's going to actually change history. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves.
So Dr. Silkworth read this book when it was in manuscript form just before it went to the printer. And he knew most of these people. He had met almost all of the first 100, and he knew about them. And he's telling us that since he knows them, everything they say about themselves in this book, you can rely on. So the people who say, oh, that's just a made-up story in the book or so on, according to the chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital, you can rely on everything they say about themselves in this book. It's also a good benchmark for me. can you rely on everything I say about myself? It's a good test. It's a good mirror to hold up.
And imagine, the most sober person at the time was Bill Wilson at 4 years of sobriety. So that was pretty amazing.
Yep.
Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D.
In the first several printings of the first edition, I'm going to guess it's about 12, I don't know for sure, it was not signed. It said very truly yours, XXX, M.D. And I'm guessing Dr. Silkworth didn't allow his name to be used in that early days because he was afraid it might affect his, if something happened and this thing went south, it might affect his medical practice. About printing number 12 of the first edition, he allowed them to use his name.
The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. Now, I'm just conjecturing here, but you know, Bill Wilson was a bit of a promoter. And I can imagine him getting this first letter that we just read, which is rather short, and saying, hey, doc, that's really nice, but could you please beef it up a little bit more? So when you see the next letter, I think you're going to see that it's very important that we have this second letter. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind.
So we are now given the, we're told about the twofold nature of our disease.
Of
the disease of alcoholism. It's a physical illness and it's a mental illness. We have a twofold nature.
And so that's going to all be revealed in this second letter.
Mm-hmm.
It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us.
Very, very interesting term here, first of all.
So it's in your glossary, by the way.
Yeah, and why don't you give the definition in the glossary?
The definition is rather long, but it's a condition of heightened susceptibility to a substance that when taken in similar amounts is innoxious or harmless to a majority of the same group.
So what the doctor has just told us is that alcohol is innocuous to other people. It doesn't harm other people. Alcohol is not a drug. Oh, I bet that's new news. Alcohol is classified as a food by the Food and Drug Administration. I'm going to use the expression throughout this discussion here of 10%. 10% of the people who use alcohol have the propensity to have the physical allergy. They may have that physical allergy. I get that information from the National Council on Alcoholism, who suggests that it's between 8 and 14% of the people who use alcohol might have that problem. So I round it to 10, just for our purposes of our conversation here. So an allergy means my body treats alcohol differently than the normal human being, like the 90% of the population. I have other allergies. I have hay fever, but I don't need to go to Ragweed Anonymous because it isn't coupled with a mental obsession. Mm-hmm. And an obsession is an idea that cannot be overcome by another idea. So keep those in mind as we read through the doctor's opinion here.
As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. Meaning, okay, we might not understand what this doctor is talking about, but our opinion really doesn't matter. He's the doctor. He's saying we have an allergy.
Mm-hmm.
But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged.
In this book, when they use the term hospitalization, what they mean is a 3 to 5 day stay in a hospital to detox. Detox, so it's not the 30-day treatment thing that we think of today. It's a 3 to 5 day medically supervised detoxification.
And the word altruistic is in your glossary. So they're saying we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plain. Altruistic just means selfless. More often than not, it is imperative, that's a synonym for must, that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer.
So that's probably really good advice on the part of the doctor, I believe, or on the part of the first 100. I believe that's the case. It is good advice. But if we look at Bill's story, his childhood friend, Ebby, brought the message of recovery to Bill when he was blind drunk. According to the story, he'd been drinking all day, and the message got through. So it's not my job to say how sober or how drunk he must be. If I have an opportunity to carry the message, I do. Maybe I have to do it again because he may not remember anything I said, and that's okay. So here's the doctor's second letter. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction."
So in other words, this book might not be for everyone.
Yeah,
it might not be that important to those who are not afflicted or overcome with alcoholic addiction.
But if you're an alcoholic, it's of paramount importance. You know the Paramount movie thing, the big tall peak mountain? That's what they're talking
about. Top of the mountain.
Top of the mountain. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. So the hospital does that, AA does not. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute on a few words on a subject which he's covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Here's the chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital saying that the subject of alcoholism is covered in masterly detail on these pages. Wow, pretty high praise. We doctors have realized for a long time that some sort of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. So moral psychology has a very long definition. If you Googled it or if you went on Wikipedia to see what it was, it has a long, long definition. For our purposes here, for the purposes of discussion of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we can think of it in terms of talk therapy, sitting down with a therapist and having conversations. That's an oversimplification, but it will work for our purposes. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So Dr. Silkworth is saying, I'm a scientist. I do not understand the spiritual realm. I haven't been trained in that area, and they are outside of my training, my synthetic knowledge.
And my synthetic knowledge is my man-made knowledge, yeah. Whereas the powers from good that are in that sentence are referring to powers from a higher power. And he's just not equipped at this point to understand and apply those powers, but you're going to see that he's very much accepting that a spiritual approach is necessary.
Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book, and he's referring to Bill Wilson, our New York co-founder, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical applications after 6 months.
Oh, not quite.
Not right. Look at how fast they tell us to start working the steps. At once, he put into practical application at once. That kind of debunks the people who say you should take your time working the steps. That is not the opinion of the authors of this book. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. Yeah, I can imagine. It's Bill's third time in that place.
Yeah, the doctor's thinking, what's different, Bill?
Yeah, but the miracle is that he said yes, that they consented. And it's partly because of the way Bill approached them. He asked for the privilege of being allowed to tell his story. And we need to remember that as members of AA, when we go to treatment centers, rehabs, hospitals, and those kinds of places, it is not our birthright. They do not need to have us there. It is a privilege for us to be able to come back to those places. And in my opinion, we need to say please and thank you. The cases we followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field.
So here's the first time we're going to see the word unselfish, and that word selfish is definitely defined in the glossary because we're going to be using it quite a bit when we get to the fourth column in the fourth step. But selfish essentially means influenced by personal motives to the disregard of the welfare or wishes of others. when you put an un in front of it, he's saying these people are just the opposite. They're very altruistic or selfless. And the fact that they do it for fun and for free, and they've developed a community spirit, he sees all those components coming together for the good.
They, these alcoholics, believe in themselves, and still more in the power, capitalized, meaning it's a synonym for God or deity, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death.
Oh, so you mean when you go to look up AA on the internet to find out a phone number and you find it under self-help, that might be a little bit of a miscategorization? So self-help is our problem, and they're telling us here that it's a power greater than ourselves that's going to help us. So it's a God help program, not a self-help program.
Now, we've already used the term God, among others, higher power and so on, power, quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
On page 47, they say to us, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own concept of God.
Mm-hmm.
This applies too to other spiritual expressions you will find in this book. Nobody in AA, nobody gets to tell you what your higher power should be. It is whatever you believe it to be.
Mm-hmm.
We are not in the business of religion, which is a religious order that tells you how to believe. We don't do that. It's whatever you believe. So, back to the bottom of the page. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. Very important sentence there. The craving that is developed by our consumption of alcohol, in alcoholics only this refers to, is not the way we use craving today.
Mm-hmm.
If I drive into the White Castle drive-thru, the person in the store on the microphone is going to holler back at me and they're going to say, what's your craving today? If I go to Taco Bell on their little tray liners, the paper that sits on the tray that they give my food to me on, they will say that tells me the website for Taco Bell, and it says it is cravings to go. That's not the way the word was used in the 1930s. Here, Dr. Silkworth is talking about a physical craving for liquor. And it means that when I put alcohol in my body, I cannot stop drinking any more than I could stop going to the bathroom if I have diarrhea or stop sneezing if I have hay fever. I'm allergic to ragweed. If I start sneezing, I cannot think my way into not sneezing. If I have diarrhea, I can't think about it and then not go to the bathroom. It doesn't work. It's physical. Once the physical phenomenon of craving has started, one of three things must intervene in order to get me separated from alcohol. The first is that I be physically separated from alcohol. Maybe I go to jail. Maybe I go to detox. Maybe I'm just not smart enough to buy enough to last all night. None of my friends will bring me any. That's number one. Number two, I pass out. That's the body's way of taking care of itself. It says, you're drinking too much here, and my body can't handle anymore, and you just black out. You just pass out. Number three, the other way that I can be separated from alcohol is I die. One of those three things must occur to separate me from alcohol and the physical phenomenon of craving. So Dr. Silkworth goes on to say this about that physical phenomenon. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation or an outcome of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in an average temperate drinker. A phenomenon is something that I know exists, I can prove it exists, I just don't know what causes it. That's the definition of the word phenomenon.
It's in your glossary, and they tell us it's a rare, significant, observable fact.
There you go. These allergic types, substitute alcohol, can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So that means that I cannot consume alcohol in any form, and that's what they say. And so that means I can't have near beer. Non-alcoholic beer has alcohol in it. The Food and Drug Administration in the United States allows food and beverage manufacturers to say non when what they really mean is below a certain threshold. So they'll call it non-alcoholic beer. It actually has alcohol in it. So I would suggest that we all, as alcoholics, need to become label readers. You see, diabetics have known for years that they are allowed to say sugar-free on certain labels when what they really mean is below a certain threshold. And a diabetic needs to know exactly how much of that stuff they consume every day. It's very important to their health. So I need to know if there's any alcohol in it, not what the marketing people said on the front of the label. I need to know what the scientists tell me on the back of the label. So I need to not have alcohol in any form at all. Now, some of the information I'm going to give you here comes from the website ballyfitness.com, B-A-L-L-Y, fitness. Why them? Well, they're interested in the total well-being of their clientele. And they're going to tell me about the myth in society that alcohol cooks off. It does not. Alcohol has what chemists call a half-life. When exposed to heat over time, it reduces by half, by half, by half, by half. But it never completely goes away. Here's their example. Food that simmers or is sautéed in liquor for 15 minutes can retain 40% of the alcohol content. When the spirits are added to boiling sauces and then removed from the heat, as much as 85% of the alcohol remains. So we need to be careful about how much alcohol we consume. So no more grandma's rum balls for Christmas. And if I go to a restaurant, Mary and I are both alcoholics, as we told you, so I need to tell the waitstaff, I'm an alcoholic. It's terrible. I can't have any alcohol. I don't need to do that. I say to the wait staff, I'm allergic to alcohol. Has this food been prepared in any alcohol? And the wait staff, almost always in the United States, have been trained when somebody uses the word allergy, you go back to the kitchen and find out because they don't want to get sued. So they go back. They will very often come out with a misinformation and they say, yes, but it cooks off. But we now know scientifically that that's not true. So does that mean I can't have any chocolate chip cookies? Well, I have to tell you that my wife, Mary, here, is the world champion chocolate chip cookie maker. Not really, but she could be. And I eat them all the time because she uses a non-alcoholic version of vanilla extract. Vanilla extract, if you buy the regular vanilla extract in a store, is 170 proof. 85% alcohol. But she buys the non-alcoholic version of that. You can always find it in your corner co-op health food store. You can often find it in mainstream grocery stores. It's quite a bit more expensive. The kind that contains alcohol is probably $1.50, $2. The other stuff is $10. So, but how much do you use, really? You know, not that much.
So the other thing we want to think about when it talks about the different types of forms would be cough medicine, which I think Dick needs a little of right now, and Listerine, some mouthwash, and of course we talked about the different cooking extracts. I know of people who've gotten drunk on lemon extract. Mm-hmm. So again, we don't know what's going to trip us into that craving, but for me, I am very aware of what I'm putting in my body and whether there's any chance that there'd be alcohol in it. And if there is, I turn away from it.
So if you went to your doctor and you said, so doc, how much alcohol can I consume before the physical phenomenon of craving starts? The truth is, he doesn't know. He doesn't know because no one knows. Nobody can tell us. And it's different in each human being. With me, it might be a chocolate chip cookie made with lemon extract or with vanilla extract. Mm-hmm. With somebody else, it might be
two near beers.
We don't know. No one can tell us. And so the question for me to you is, do you want to play Russian roulette? You know what that is, where you put a bullet in the chamber of a six-shooter, spin it, and put it up to your temple and pull the trigger and hope it is the empty chamber that it landed on. So do you want to do that, or do you want to just avoid alcohol? So I'm going to read that sentence again. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit, they found they cannot break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance on things human, their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices.
Here's what soft, frothy emotional appeal sounds like. Dick, what in the world is the matter with you? Don't you love your children? That's what people used to say to me when I was drinking. That's frothy emotional appeal. Of course I love my children, but once I put alcohol in my body, I could not stop drinking.
So frothy's in your glossary, and it just means empty or frivolous. It just isn't going to appeal to the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight.
And that message for me was the man who 12-stepped me. He told me enough of his story that he saw my head nodding up and down, that I could relate to what he was telling me. He was telling me enough of his drinking story that I knew what he was talking about. And then he said to me a message that had depth and weight. He said, "You don't have to live like that anymore." That's a message coming from a man who had been like me, walked in my shoes, been where I'd been, and he's telling me I don't have to live the horrible life that I've been living. That's a powerful message.
In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives.
Hang on to your backside. You're going warp speed to a place of serenity that you cannot even conceive of. Once you've worked the 12 steps, your life is recreated. It doesn't go back to the way it was. It goes to an absolutely incredible place.
If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical or doubting will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them.
We have found nothing. It's your best shot at recovery.
And he keeps emphasizing the fact that the movement is selfless, this growing movement. They're not in it for profit. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
Well, duh, of course we do. But that's new news to a lot of non-alcoholics who were also, assuming that they were going to read this doctor's opinion. My sister, a non-alcoholic in my family, is in the helping professions, and she's interested in what's in this book. And so when we read that sentence, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, she says, I don't like that effect. I don't like feeling woozy. I feel out of control. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, let's rock and roll. Mm-hmm. See, my sister has a completely different reaction to alcohol than I do. She doesn't like the feeling, and I do like the feeling.
The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious,
meaning it hurts us,
they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity.
So I watch my sister drink wine, doesn't seem to have a problem with her, so I think, well, it's the scotch that I drink. Well, I get the same result from wine. So.
And the word impunity is in your glossary. It just means without any punishment or harm. So they're going, wow, I don't understand. These other people can take drinks and have no consequences. But it's totally different for me as an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
After they have succumbed or given in to the desire.
So that desire to drink. So we're going to give in. We're going to drink. We're going to take a drink or two.
And guess where the desire comes from? It comes from the mind.
Uh-huh.
They pass through the well-known.
No, and.
Oops. Oh, the most important part.
Yep.
I'm going to start at the beginning.
Yeah.
After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops.
That's the physical craving.
They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
In this book, and particularly in this chapter, they use the term psychic change, a personality change, spiritual experience, and spiritual awakening interchangeably. They all mean the same thing. So the psychic means thinking. So they say unless you this person can experience an entire change of thinking, mm-hmm. or his personality changes, or he has a spiritual experience, or he has a spiritual awakening, there's little chance of little hope of his recovery.
MMPI?
Oh, yeah, we're going to do that after the next paragraph.
Okay. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred,
thinking change,
the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
Look at what Dr. Silkworth calls the steps. Rules. Pretty interesting. Now, a number of years ago, I had an opportunity to have lunch and a conversation with a man by the name of Dr. George Mann. Dr. Mann was one of the five people in the United States that invented the so-called Minnesota model of treatment, which was the main way people stayed sober for decades, did treatment. And I asked Dr. Mann, I said, so Dr. Silkworth back in 1939 said that the 12 steps provided an entire psychic change, and that is what the change in thinking is what got us sober. I said, is that true? Do we really know if that's actual fact, or was this just theory on his part that's been debunked? And Dr. Mann said to me, Dr. Mann, by the way, is a non-alcoholic. I don't know if I said that. And he was also a medical director of a hospital-based treatment center in St. Paul, Minnesota. And he said, Dick, it is true. He said, if you took an MMPI, if you know what that is, it stands for the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Index. If you've ever been in the armed services of the United States, you took an MMPI. Many school children took it in a 6th, 7th, 8th grade, something like that. Not all. But it is a measurement of personality. That's what it's designed to do. And he said, if you took an MMPI, which I did, and he said, then if you get sober using the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you take another MMPI, now this outcome is not true if you only work 11 of the steps. It's only true if you work all 12 steps to the best of your ability. He said, you take a second MMPI, a trained psychiatrist cannot tell that it's the same human being. The personality change is so complete and so profound as the result of working the 12 steps that a trained psychiatrist can't tell that it's the same person. And that has been borne out by a number of more modern tests. They have PET scans and so on that we can actually look at the brain of an alcoholic before and after, and they have discovered that that is true, that there is a change. There's a psychic change that occurs, a personality change that occurs as the result of working the 12 steps.
Let's pick up on what you said about the fact that we work all 12 steps, not 11, or not just a cafeteria-style approach and choose the steps that might be comfortable for us. Let's go to page 59, because Dr. Silkworth is calling these rules. Mm-hmm. He's calling the 12 steps rules. And I'd like you to explain the comma.
Oh,
on 59. Page
59. 50, I thought you said 69. Okay.
No.
Yeah, you know, you hear in AA all the time, these steps are suggested.
Mm.
Well, they get that information from reading on page 59, beginning of second full paragraph. It says, here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. People that say the steps are suggested by using that sentence don't understand the King's English. There is a comma in that sentence. And I've checked this out with lots and lots of English teachers. A comma is a thought separator. So they say, here are the steps we took, comma, which are suggested as a program of recovery. The program is recovered.
Suggested.
The program is suggested in this way. So you have a problem with alcohol. Well, I can suggest several programs that you might want to do. You could go to a hospital-based treatment program. You can go to see your church minister, your priest minister, or rabbi. You can see a psychiatrist. There's lots of programs of recovery that I could suggest to you. But inside of each of those, there are rules. if you go to a treatment program, you have to figure out how you're going to get them paid, either through your own money or insurance or the like. If you go to your priest, minister, or rabbi, they have some rules about sleeping with the minister's wife. It's a rule. And if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, we have rules, as Dr. Silkworth just indicated, and there's 12 of them, and they're called 12 steps. Here are the steps we took, comma, new thought, which are suggested as a program of recovery. So people who say the steps are suggested are doing a disservice to the text material here.
Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. So here's Dr. Silkworth being very humble.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he doesn't have all the answers. I know I was lucky enough to have a therapist when I was struggling with my alcoholism and finally admitted I had a problem, who said to me, "Mary, all the doctors in the world might think they can help you, but I have seen the greatest success come from those who go and work the 12 steps of AA. I suggest you go immediately." And I was one of the lucky ones.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a doctor who decided, "Oh, here's somebody with great insurance. I think I'll attempt, you know, to work on her alcoholism." So she had the same humble attitude that Dr. Silkworth did. "One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change."
So now he's talking about a psychic change, but he's saying it's an essential psychic change.
And again, that more than human power is going to get us more closely into our higher power. Though the aggregate or total of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control.
Mental obsession.
I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not made.
They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the physical phenomenon of craving became paramount.
And they couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control.
A physical craving.
There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Supreme sacrifice means they kill themselves. Now, they're going to give us five classifications of alcoholics. They're going to say they're not going to do much detail, but they're going to briefly review five different types of alcoholics. Here's type one.
Classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book.
Type one.
There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. I think that's a reference to the water wagon.
Yeah.
Like they're going to stop drinking alcoholically or alcohol and go on and drink just water. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
Type two.
There's a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment.
Type 3.
There's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger.
Type 4.
There's the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written.
But it won't. And then there's type 5.
Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people.
And that's the one that those of us in AA like to think ourselves of, but here's the important piece of that, this next sentence.
All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated or eliminated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
Stop drinking.
The word abstinence is in your glossary. And again, as Dick said, the short thing is stop drinking. This immediately precipitates or throws us into a seething cauldron of debate.
Why?
Well,
it's because in society at this time, 1939, there was a debate going on in the halls of Congress and in our society as a whole about alcohol and whether it's bad and that sort of thing. We had just come out of Prohibition, and there was that debate still raging in society. So this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written, pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed.
What is the solution? So here we are. We finally get to the hope. Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism.
This man that they're writing about is a man by the name of Hank Parkhurst. He is the author of Chapter 10, Two Employers, Chapter 10 in the text section. And so that's who we're talking about here. Hank's story is no longer in the back of the book, but it is the first or the leading story in our compilation of all the stories, the book's Experience, Strength, and Hope, and it's the title is referred to as The Unbeliever.
He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. So not only did he have a physical illness going on, his stomach was bleeding, he was falling apart mentally with this mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope.
Step one. So we know that Hank did at least step one.
Following the elimination of alcohol, meaning stop drinking, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book.
So that's step two, and the inference is he worked the rest of the steps, although they don't say that. But so we know for a fact from Dr. Silkworth that Hank worked at step one and step two and probably worked the rest of the steps.
1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features. But there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. It's kind of interesting because people say, how is it that you can't recognize him? Well, you know, sometimes people are bloated from drinking. When we become sober, we take better care of our bodies sometimes. We look different, and the biggest change is that we act differently. So perhaps in conversation he was interested in the other person rather than talking about himself. So that's a big change. When I needed a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York.
This man is named Fitz. His real name is John Fitzhugh Mayo. He's the author of the story in the back of the book, Our Southern Friend, on page 208. But he's also mentioned on page 55 of the text material.
The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the, quote, willpower, end quote, to resist the impulse to drink.
At a lot of AA meetings that I go to, when we read that, there's a big chuckle in the room.
His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book.
So my dad was born in 1902. This is the language his language was the language they're using in this book. And I can remember my dad coming home, and at the dinner table he'd say, I'm really sold on getting that John Deere lawnmower. What that meant was he was going to go out the next day and do it and buy that John Deere lawnmower. I can hear him talking like that today. So that's what they meant here. He became sold. He did
the work
that's in the book.
He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet.
We sure don't talk like that anymore, do we?
I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D.
So the doctor's given us our first homework assignment, and that is that we're going to be asked to read this book through. And to read a book through means to start at the hardcover, or the cover, and read every page in between and end at the back cover, reading the black only. So the question is, are you willing to do that? Are we willing to do that as alcoholics? We're going to stop there. That's the end of, we're about 75 minutes into this, which is just about how long we want to do each session. And we'll stop here. You can go on to tape number 2.